Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. This week, we observed the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. New Mexico was still a young state when the war started, and yet it was eager to show its patriotic fervor and prove itself a worthy addition to the country. In the book, Lest We Forget, World War I and New Mexico, author David Holtby, former editor of UNM Press, examines how the war affected the state, including the University of New Mexico, which provided a great deal of the materials he used in his research. Why did you want to write a book that explores World War I through the lens of New Mexico?
Few states have recounted what World War I meant to those citizens. New Mexico had an incredible archive that I could tap. We're only one of six that has statements from servicemen when they returned from the war. But mainly I was interested because as a vet myself, I knew something of the Spanish-American War, some stories, the Rough Riders, and from World War II, of course. But what I knew about World War I, you could put in a thimble. I knew that we had been in the war and obviously had some participation. And I'm sure today we can talk a lot about what UNM, University of New Mexico, of which I'm a grad, what their role, which was quite interesting, quite diverse. It illustrates one of the themes of my book that when you understand the particular, you really get a sense of the universal. That is, if you can get your hands around and grasp what was happening locally, you have begun to pull the threads of all the themes that are present throughout the war. And that was very true of UNM's experience.
What was UNM's role during World War I?
We actually had the same roles that the society in general, and these were really threefold. Certainly, we had a lot of men in uniform. The figure that
This is New Mexico in general? Okay.
Yeah. So New Mexico in general had 14,000 men. Of those 14,000, 400 were from either current or former graduates or faculty of UNM. Hmm. It was about 70% of the male student body that went off to war. The entire football team and all the coaches signed up and enlisted in the military. The campus became a training ground briefly for about 4 months for the New Mexico National Guard before they went off to their permanent camp. Several acres on campus, probably close to where we are here in Oñate Hall, were a campus garden. Everyone was encouraged to grow more food, and so UNM did that right away. UNM also released any student who needed to return to the family farm or ranch to help increase productivity of whatever their bounty would be, whether it would be cattle, sheep, or corn, whatever. The role of women in the war was very important. So what UNM did was absolutely one of these little microcosms. It's where the particular does reveal the universal. So in 1919, the campus issued a publication. It's still available, and actually it's available online through Google Books. And it's called War Service of the University of New Mexico, and it was an official publication. In it, they recount all that the males did, but they also had an effort, and they could identify 27 women, again, current or former students, who had participated in the war effort. Nine of them ended up in different agencies in Washington, D.C. One who made it over to France, a really interesting woman I wish I knew more about. Her name was Agnes Childers, and she was in charge of a Red Cross canteen in Brest. Well, now, Brest is essential in France because it's the main port to which all men coming from the United States arrived. It was also the headquarters of the U.S. Navy.
We also have the records, I believe, of the Women's Auxiliary of the State Council of Defense.
Absolutely.
Which you touched on. Women were this huge force on the home front.
They were, and they have been all but forgotten. The Women's Auxiliary, organized in every state, had two main functions. One, They were to develop gardens, either individually or in groups, and a number of the group activities involved whole communities. And another food related was to conserve food. So they had wheatless days and meatless days. So women were the kind of sentinels of the kitchen, was the phrase. They were to conserve food so that more could be shipped abroad, both to troops and to our allies. The other activity women did, they were key in, to finance the war, was an incredible undertaking. It cost the United States for 19 months, it cost them $1 million every hour of the war. And New Mexico was given a quota of $11 million to raise in four fundraising campaigns. You would basically buy savings bonds. It had a five-year maturity at a very low interest rate. New Mexico, in Washington, D.C., they set a very low $11 million ceiling. They said, well, it'd be great if they could come somewhere near that. We actually exceeded it by 58% and raised almost $19 million. Greatly surprised, but women in New Mexico raised one quarter of the money. That's an enormous amount of money.
They also, they called it the land army. Did they actually go and replace agricultural workers? I know this happened in England too.
Absolutely. And a truly incredible woman who organized garden activities first in 1917 in Luna and Grant County. She lived near Silver City. Woman named Isabella Ferguson. The Women's Land Army, yeah, there were over 500 of them organized all by then Isabella Ferguson, and they replaced the men not only to plant and summertime weed and tend, but in the fall harvest, but also they had a large section of them that would pick the orchard crops, especially in the southern part of the state, a significant and often overlooked contribution.
You also had these great stories that about women like Bertha Becker, who was basically an early version of an extension agent.
Yes. So she's given a car, and she knew how to not only drive but maintain this car so that with great frequency she was out 40, 50 miles in Valencia County primarily and driving not just roads but arroyos and mesas. And her goal, to individually contact the homemakers in very rural part and show them what the government regulations were for the wheatless and the meatless days, and also maternity care. It was just a whole host of things to bring education and kind of improved practices to these very isolated homemakers. The car was forever breaking down, and she was several times lauded in newspaper stories for her resourcefulness and ability to just forge ahead despite the odds.
Did you find these stories about Isabella Ferguson and Bertha Becker that was all in the records here at UNM?
Yes, okay. Those came out of several separate collections.
You also tapped the Spanish language newspaper La Bandera Americana.
That was incredible for a couple of things. Let me tell you a couple of stories. So we all know about the influenza pandemic. It really hit home with me when you would see the obituaries where they would talk about their little angel taking flight, and then they would list the day. The number of deaths of children under two is just staggering. The Albuquerque newspaper, then called the Morning Journal, would have some, but the Spanish language, La Bandera Americana, had it seemingly as a particular mission to provide some kind of comfort and community solace by writing and presenting a lot of these. But they have two other good qualities. It's a way to see how people responded, especially in the Nueva Mexicana or Mexicano community. And so food regulations were particularly embraced, and they would sometimes come out with editorials saying, it doesn't help our soldiers on the front if you're not saving food. They're the ones who need the food. So you get a sense of patriotism, of kind of community involvement. But you also have government regulations and materials reproduced that I did not find in the English language papers. And so those were kind of a running commentary on what was happening in the war.
You touched on the influenza epidemic. Of the many students from UNM who went to war, one died in combat, three died from influenza.
Yes.
How is that emblematic of the larger reality during that time?
Across the 14,000 men in uniform, the percents were 54% of those who died were victims of illness or disease, primarily the influenza pandemic of the fall of 1918. Only 26% were combat-related deaths. And that figure on the home front, we didn't have any way to collect the data, so there are estimates. But the usual figure given is about 3,000 New Mexican civilians. But the role that what I call the unintended consequence of war, and that is to release a worldwide influenza pandemic, became an incredible instrument of death. It's estimated more than 75 to 100 million people died worldwide. Here at UNM, there were several deaths, one on campus among a student who was enrolled in the what was called the Student Army Training Corps. Two were in France. One, a man named Hugh Carlisle, whose name we still remember today if you drive around.
Carlisle Boulevard's name for him.
Yeah. He was on a transport ship over to France. They were a couple of days away. And when you died in those circumstances, they did not bury you at sea. You would land in Brest, and they would transport you to near Paris to a cemetery that was in the news just a few days ago, Suresnes.
This is University Showcase on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick. I'm speaking with David Holtby about his book, Lest We Forget, World War I and New Mexico. Holtby is the former editor of UNM Press and drew upon numerous records held at UNM to write the book. This week, we observed the 100th anniversary of the end of the war. You also were able at UNM, you could look at draft records.
Yes.
And also requests to not be drafted.
Yes.
I'm curious what you learned from
those. Anyone who did not earn $360 a year, which would be a dollar a day, draft boards felt they were doing them a favor by putting them in uniform because they were earning less as a civilian. In addition, the military would pay $15 if married to the wife and $5 for each children.
For a month or a...
For the duration.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, for the duration. And those monies were mailed directly, and it's what supported the families on the home front. Once Congress put that into place, you started to see fewer and fewer draft exemptions for what they called dependent support. They had two categories that were closely examined and were considered justified. One was if you were indispensable in your agricultural work or indispensable through some defense-related work. You also see just the incredible diversity of occupations that the Army was wanting. So driving a vehicle is just becoming somewhat common. They look for people who had driving skills, people who were, say, miners and were used to explosives. Now, a lot still became infantrymen, to be sure, and New Mexicans were typical of these. The average draftee from New Mexico had a second to third grade education, was about 25 years old, and they had been working probably since they were 12 or 14 years old. They were used to very hard, very demanding work, and life in the Army was exactly that. Sometimes they would go as much as 96 hours without food. The water was no problem. It was raining all the time. So New Mexico's men were in many ways very adapted to what combat would thrust upon them. People out of cities did not have that kind of background and often just could not keep up. The number of men who were exempted was rather small. But the real eliminator were the draft physicals, both at the county level and once you got to training camp. And New Mexico had a very low rate of failure of the draft physical, about 25%. National average was 50%. Places like Arizona, California, Colorado, it was close to 60%. Hmm. So we were a bit hardier, if you will.
You have some very moving stories about men who don't come back and were the only source of support, maybe for elderly parents in a rural area.
So the one case that really comes to mind, a man named Arturo Montoya from Roy, then in Mora County, and he had parents who at the end of the war were in their upper 70s. Now, what the government had done was provide life insurance, very affordable life insurance. Well, the family needed that, and it was slow in forthcoming. And so the state kind of reached out and became kind of grief counselors for them, helped them with the government paperwork. But it struck me in the last letter that the father, who's in his upper 70s, said, "My wife and I feel abandoned." He was their only son. He was what kept the farm going, and they had no idea. Mm. Even though they would collect that insurance, and
but they couldn't work the land.
Yeah, they couldn't work the land, and how do you replace your only son?
So 70-80% of male students at UNM 70% of male students at UNM enlisted. We had a very high participation rate overall in the state. Set the historical context for that. We're a very new state. We have a heavily Hispanic population. It seemed in your book there was a push for people to be especially patriotic and show they supported this war to prove that, yes, we deserve to be
part
of the state or part of the union.
It was a way for this state to finally tell the rest of the nation, all those years when you doubted that we would be loyal and productive citizens, we are that. We had the fifth highest per capita enlistment rate in the nation. We exceeded our quota for the savings bonds by almost 60%. Those were great hallmarks of contribution. There are some more invisible ones that I came across when I was recently rereading the 1919 UNM publication. One of our graduates from 1901 had gone on to become a professor at Columbia University, and his specialty in geography came to the attention of the key advisor to President Wilson. He was made a major, sent off to Paris, and headed the division for the Americans on the Boundary Commission. Now, that man helped kind of clarify and redefine some boundaries among European nations. Another man whose name listeners will perhaps recall, Charles Lemke, who lived to be 100 years old. He, in World War I, was 28 years old. He was an artillery officer. And the week before the war ended, he is hit with machine gun fire from a German airplane. He was hit in the head. He was reported dead. His family thought he was dead. Somehow he survived, spent time in French, British, and American hospitals, came back, joined his father's construction company, and Lemke Construction built much of downtown Albuquerque, built on our campus 17 of the buildings. They were a major player in large-scale construction, commercial construction in Albuquerque. These are, you know, individual contributions that our campus made, but they are, as I say, emblematic. Throughout America, you could, universities such as Yale, Columbia, and Stanford in particular, sent over numbers of volunteers as officers. Regrettably, massive numbers of those were killed. The average life expectancy of a lieutenant on the front line was 17 days.
What were the most significant impacts?
You mentioned one, and that's the psychological kind of, we told you so. Yes, we are loyal, and we did more than our fair share. There was that. On the negative side, it resulted in about one quarter of the men who came back leaving, and probably not just their community, but actually leaving the state. The exodus to California, which I talk about in some length after the war, was significant. Happened again just before and during World War II. I tell the story of a man who had entered the Navy from Zuni Pueblo. McDaniel was his last name. He then went on to college in Oregon and had a career with the Indian Service in Oklahoma, illustrative of those who came back and immediately went elsewhere. We had a very small black population. I talked about a young man who had what you could do at that time in Albuquerque. You could be a railroad porter, and so that's what he had been. After the war, he comes back, and he immediately decides to go to Detroit. And in the 1930 census, he is working in an automobile manufacturing as an electrician. These were losses to us in human capital, but gains to the nation elsewhere, and really represented a kind of upward mobility within their lives. So much of New Mexico was rural and agricultural, and it remained that way. But others found opportunities and pursued those.
Well, I want to thank you for coming and talking about your book.
Thank you, Megan. It's been a pleasure.
That was David Holtby, former editor of UNM Press and author of Lest We Forget, World War I and New Mexico. Now we go to the part of University Showcase, where we learn about research you may never have heard about.
Nobody's ever gonna read this!
This is Marty Adamsmith, afternoon freeform host, in the studio with Jens Van Hasel of the University of New Mexico Department of Linguistics, a PhD student and Greenberg Fellow, the second such recipient of that award, to be on the show alongside Lucas Denk and also alongside Josefina Bitar, the second linguist to do their research primarily in Paraguay. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yes, yeah, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And so unlike Josefina, whose research is about Guarani, the indigenous language spoken by the majority of Paraguayans, you're focusing on a very small language spoken by few rurally residing small community members, and it's called Sanapana, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Great.
The language is called Sanapana, just like the people that speak it. There are about 3,000 people living in the Paraguayan Chaco, which is a kind of lowland desert area there, and about a third of the ethnic group, so about 800 to 1,000 people still speak the language.
Okay, so it has been losing ground to Spanish and to Guarani, I'm guessing?
Yes, mainly to Guarani.
What's something that you found that makes this language unique?
There are people who expect small languages like this that are spoken in somewhat isolated rural communities to show relatively little variation, because they're usually very tight-knit communities.
And no variation would mean like every person more or less speaks the language in the same way.
Exactly, yeah.
Like everybody has a different mouth and a different lung capacity and stuff like that, but they're all kind of shooting for the same target.
Yes. What I'm looking at right now is that this language has quite a lot of variation in their vowel productions.
Mm-hmm.
So the language only has three vowels. They only have E, A, and O. But certain people or certain groups of people seem to be pronouncing the E and the O with their tongue higher in their mouth, so sounding more like what we think of as U and E. My hypothesis so far is that that seems to be due to contact with Spanish and Guarani, which do have these vowels. So that the younger generations who are more and more multilingual, speaking Spanish and Guarani, their Sanapana undergoes influence from these contact languages. This specific kind of variation clearly has a lot to do with the social context and how that has changed over the last couple of decades. And that is something that UNM is very engaged with.
Talk to me about the history of the current Sanapana communities. How did they start out?
So I think records start in the late 1800s, when the Sanapana and the other people from that language family, that's called Entlet and Entlet, they lived in nomadic or semi-nomadic groups, living from mainly hunting and gathering, until basically the Paraguayan government privatized that whole region and sold those lands to Argentinian and Brazilian companies. which then started to put down fences in those lands, you know, delimiting the hunting grounds of the indigenous peoples. So that kind of forced those people to settle down, become sedentary, first in the factories, where they got exploited, basically, in the tannin trade. That's the product that is used for tanning. It's a liquid that comes from a certain kind of tree. And then in the 1930s, various groups of missionaries came to Paraguay. They were given lands as well by the Paraguayan government, and they went around and tried to get the indigenous people together and bring them together in missions and mission settlements.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the Sanapana live now. I think there's 5 or 6 villages where the largest part of the population is Sanapana, and they were founded by missionaries. Family ties and community ties are really strong, and people cannot stay away for too long without being kind of regarded as abandoning the community.
Ooh.
So each year they have to come back for at least a certain period of time.
Right. What do you see as the main potential benefit of your research on this community for this community?
This summer we started working on an encyclopedia, me mainly together with one of the community elders, one of the people who helped found the community. I think that could really have an impact, because more and more people of the younger generations are not very much acquainted anymore with the traditional uses of plants and animals, like medicinal uses, how to construct cultural objects, things like that. And that's what we've been trying to do now, kind of record the traditional knowledge about the plants and the animals of the Chaco region and get that all down in a Sanapana Spanish Guarani encyclopedia.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's a project of definitely a long-term project. But yeah, if that gets finished, that should really be helpful, hopefully, for the community itself.
Awesome. So I've named this segment, Nobody's Ever Going to Read This.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I like to talk about with people are the sacrifices that they've made to expand human knowledge.
Right.
It's a difficult enterprise, especially in the social sciences and the humanities. There's an oversupply of people with this training of about 10 to 1
mm-hmm.
Compared with the number of positions open for them. So you're originally from Belgium, from Ghent, right?
Yes.
You do have the Greenberg Fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
So you were brought to UNM with a, you know, comfortable standard of living for
that's correct.
Albuquerque, New Mexico. But what have you given up to pursue this line?
Well, moving to the U.S. is already first kind of obvious thing that's on the table, you know, being away from your family for
being away from your family. I thought you meant having to live in the U.S.
Well, you know, not going to say too much about that. But yeah, living away from my family, my girlfriend is from Canada, so not being together with her all the time, that's, you know, sometimes hard. But I think the main thing is that to do work like this, my dissertation is hopefully going to be a complete grammatical description of the Sanapana language.
Mm-hmm.
So to do that, obviously, you have to spend a lot of time in the field, you know. I've been there for two-month periods so far, which is not that long. But next year, for example, I'll be going for 5-6 months. You know, at this period in my life is when a lot of my friends back in Belgium are at the point of getting married and starting to have families. A lot of that I will most likely have to miss, you know.
Mm.
If friends are getting married in next October or something, and I happen to be in Paraguay, I can't just fly back and forth for that wedding.
Yeah.
So yeah, there is quite a bit of personal stuff that you miss out on doing work like this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say that's the main sacrifice I have to make.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That was Marty Adam-Smith with Jens van Heesel, a PhD student in linguistics at UNM. You can find this and all our episodes of University Showcase at KUNM.org. Thanks to UNM Associate Professor David Bashwinner for our theme music. I'm Megan Kamrick. Thank you for listening to University Showcase.